Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I've brought you back some gifts.
Ah, you're very good.
I mean, it's basically Swedish dairy milk.
Thank you.
Well, Swedish dairy milk is nicer than most dairy milks. That's very kind.
I'm actually not sure if it's mint chocolate because I can't make out the... Do you reckon
not,
it's mint?
Not chocolate.
But there's some mint leaves on it, so I guess there's mint.
That's hazelnut. That's hazelnut leaves, isn't it?
Are they hazelnut and
from the,
mint?
From the plant on which
the important bit is that it's chocolate, and that will do.
Or not.
There you are, folks. No problem. You're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat podcast. I'm news correspondent Zara King, and I'm joined in studio by my fellow news correspondent Richard Chambers.
Hello.
And political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Hello there.
How are you keeping?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, good.
You rested after your week off?
Yes, I feel very rested, actually. back to a very busy news week.
Indeed,
Richard,
it has been
fairly chaotic. There's weeks where nothing happens, and then there's days where weeks happen. Is an adapted slogan to take on this.
Feels like that, all right.
Yeah, and I suppose in terms of what we've been covering on the podcast this week, the running order changed many times in the last sort of 48 hours because stories have been breaking and developing. We're going to begin with a breaking news story just as we were coming to record tonight, and this is that the Garda Cold Case Unit is to conduct a full review of the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier in West Cork in 1996. Were you surprised to hear this, Richard?
No, it's been called for by a lot of people. I was actually speaking this evening with a former member of the Serious Crime Review Team, which is the Garda unit which will be conducting this. The motto of that unit is "The adapted is to the living we owe respect, to the dead we owe the truth." And that is really the message of what they are going to try and do. They feel that they owe a huge deal of respect to the family of Sophie Toscan de Plantier, but they need to get to the truth of what happened, which more than 25 years on, we're still no closer to finding definitively in the Irish courts what happened there. Effectively, it's going to be a lengthy exercise. There's been so much focus on this for so many years. There's been so many whispers, and people online will have heard so many rumours over the years about this. This is all about finding the facts and trying to figure out once and for all what definitively happened to Sophie Toscan de Plantier.
It'll be very interesting to see in people's minds, because so much of the story over time has almost become, and this is a very grim way to think of it, but it's sort of become theatre, because there's been so many, you know, very high profile trials and all the media coverage that comes out of that. There's been the two documentary series for TV. There's been the podcast series that I suppose for a lot of people, It feels like one of those true crime podcasts. It feels like an entire work of fiction. Like, it feels like such a detached thing, when for some people it's so thick on the ground. And I kind of wonder whether this far removed, when so much of the story is now told through secondhand documentary projects and everything else, how difficult it will be to actually get to the kernels of the truth that are out there, or to try and turn up something that hasn't shown up in the last quarter of a century.
Yeah, it is. And it's one of the challenges, especially when we know that the Garda investigation was criticised from the get-go in terms of how it was handled from the outset. What impact did that have on the evidence? And when they go to review it, what exactly is it they're reviewing? Is that evidence conclusive? So to delve further into this, we are joined now by the Southern correspondent for the Irish Independent, Ralph Regal. And Ralph is somebody who has been covering this case for more than 20 years, based in Cork. Hi, Ralph. Thank you so much for joining the group chat.
Hey, Zara. Honoured to be here.
So, Ralph, we want to begin by asking you to talk us through some of your earliest memories of covering this particular case. You've been on it now since the 90s. What was your first recollection? Do you remember when you heard about it first?
Yeah, I was in Cork in the newsroom the Christmas of 1996 when the call came through that there had been a body discovered in West Cork. Now, at the time, the Examiner had a West Cork correspondent called Eddie Cassidy. And Eddie was dealing with the story, and there was a lot of talk that it could have been a New Age traveller, that it could have been a road traffic accident victim. But very quickly it emerged that it had been a woman who had met a violent death. And then very quickly after that, then we learned that she was French And that, of course, she was very well connected within the whole French film industry. And it emerged, I think, within a couple of hours after that, then, that she was the wife of Daniel Toscan de Plantier, who was one of the best known people within the French film industry, and also one of the most influential, and who would have had contacts right across the entire French film industry and politics, including being quite friendly with the French president, Jacques Chirac.
Ralph, this has obviously taken on a life of its own over recent years. Obviously, it's now 25 years plus now since Sophie was murdered. We've had podcasts, we've had multiple documentaries and books about this. Has that focus, that international focus, has that done anything to bring up new evidence in this? Obviously, now that we have this decision to have the Serious Crime Review team examine this, has there been any impact of all of that extra scrutiny on that? Or has that hindered things in a way that you have, you know, a million people around the world who have their own theories about this and who can get in the way if they want to?
Yeah, I think we undoubtedly have this cold case review on the basis of the focus that's been on the case, particularly since the 25th anniversary, which was last year. And there were two major documentaries produced within the last 12 months. You would have had Jim Sheridan's production for Sky, and then you would have also had a Netflix production. And both of those had a significant impact. And there was a number of contacts with the Gardaí on the basis of those programmes. And certainly it increased the pressure on the Gardaí to sanction a cold case review. And of course, it's worth remembering that both the family of Sophie Toscan de Plantier had been in favour of a cold case review. And Ian Bailey, the 64-year-old former freelance journalist, poet, and the man who has been the focus of multiple extradition attempts by the French, he personally wrote to the Justice Minister, to Garda Commissioner Drew Harris, and to the Taoiseach last year, arguing that he wanted to see a cold case review. So while I think the news today is significant, it really shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone.
From a nuts and bolts perspective, Ralph, what does it actually entail? Because one would have thought that given this has been running now for so long and there's been so much international attention, the Netflix series, the Now TV series, the Audible podcast, one would have thought that pretty much everything that was to be reviewed has been reviewed at this point. So what is left to look at now?
Yeah, it has. And I mean, there have been two reviews of the original Garda case file. And there was also an internal review conducted by then Assistant Commissioner Ray McAndrew. And that review was ordered after the dramatic evidence of Marie Farrell, who, I mean, people might remember in 2003, there was a very, very high profile defamation action taken by Ian Bailey against 8 Irish and British newspapers. And the star witness of that defamation hearing before Cork Circuit Civil Court was Marie Farrell. And very dramatically, within the space of 2 years, she recanted her evidence and said that she had only made those statements on the basis of duress that she'd been put under by the Gardaí. And the McAndrew report has never been released. So this, in essence, is almost what you could call the fourth review of the original Garda case file. And the original Garda case file went to the DPP. It was sent back for clarification. And then in 2001, the Director of Public Prosecutions, having considered it at quite length for quite some time, decided that there was no basis for any further action and for no charges.
And Ralph, we know that the Gardaí were criticised for how they conducted the investigation, particularly in the early stages after this murder. You might just remind us of some of the detail of that.
Yeah, it was a confluence of events really that proved problematical for many reasons. First of all, there was a delay in getting a pathologist. So Sophie's body actually stayed outdoors for two successive evenings. And what that meant was that body temperature readings couldn't be taken. There were issues to do with the maintenance of the scene. There have been issues to do with the preservation of evidence. There has been issues. I mean, there was a complaint made by Mr. Bailey to the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission. As part of that review, it was found that there were various issues to do with, the maintenance of evidence. There was an issue to do with logbooks, how some of the actual notes in respect of the case were maintained. So there were a lot of issues. But really what it fell down to was the fact that Gardaí were, it was just one of those cases where Gardaí, they had no eyewitness. They had no major forensic evidence to work with. Of course, these were the days before extensive CCTV footage and mobile phone coverage. So they had none of that information on which to rely. And it was just, they never got the break or that little piece of good luck that so many investigations hinge on. And hence, they've never had that one crucial piece of information to lead them to a charge or to a case being brought before a judge.
Ralph, what is the atmosphere around West Cork, around this murder now, 25 years on? For so many people, if you speak to people in West Cork, it's almost like one of the seminal moments of their lives. That's something, the shock, and this is something which people should remember, the shock that this murder caused at the time was like almost nothing we'd ever seen in this country before, particularly in such a small and, you know, close-knit area. How are people feeling about it now? And I suppose, how is Pierre Louis feeling about this now? Obviously, he owns the house in question here now. Has he responded to it at this point?
Yeah, so Pierre-Louis Baudevigno, he owns the house that Sophie had purchased and she had described as a dream home. And of course, she was fleeing from that property and from an intruder that she apparently met. And she was beaten to death within sight of that property. So his position has always been that a cold case review, anything that would result in new evidence being examined that might lead to that one crucial piece of information that could change things in terms of a prosecution in Ireland, that the family were in favour of. But he's also been very, very strong in the fact that, of course, the French mounted their own prosecution in 2019. And in that case, in a Paris court in May of 2019, Ian Bailey, he was tried in absentia. And he was convicted by a French court. Now, Mr. Bailey has always said that it was a show trial, that it was a travesty of justice, and that he was convicted ever before the trial was staged in France. And he is in favour of a cold case review here in Ireland because his position has been that a cold case review will finally exonerate him and show that he had nothing to do with this crime, as he has always said since December of 1996.
And of course, Ralph, the tragic reality of all this is, despite, you know, all the documentaries, the podcasts, all of the hype that has surrounded this case for Sophie Toscan de Plantier's family, they still have not seen justice. At this point, is there anything to indicate that there are other leads for the Gardaí? I mean, Ian Bailey has always been the central suspect in this case. Does opening this and effectively reviewing evidence that arguably could be deemed inconclusive, given that we know the mistakes that were made in the early stages of that investigation, is there any reason to believe that there would be any further developments in this case over the coming months?
The one thing that covering this case for almost 25 years has taught me is that you don't make predictions, because it has always surprised and there have always been twists and turns in the case. I mean, I would have thought after the libel hearing in 2003 that the end of the case would have been in a couple of years' time. And here we are almost 20 years after that libel hearing and there are still developments in the case. I think what's going to be very interesting is that some of the new information and the new contacts that the Gardaí have received, how those contacts will change some of the original information that was in the Garda file. I mean, the Gardaí are going to go back and look at all the original witnesses. They're going to look at all the original statements. And crucially, they're also going to look at timelines. And from what my sources are telling me, the timelines are going to be the crucial element of this. Of course, they will also look at some of the forensic evidence and see, can recent developments in, say, DNA technology and things like that, can those tests offer the possibility of a breakthrough in giving them that one crucial piece of information that might actually lead to a successful prosecution?
Ralph Regal, Southern correspondent with the Irish Independent. Thank you so much for joining us on the group chat. So look, I suppose Ralph is saying their timelines are going to be crucial in terms of this review of the case and also sort of recent developments when it comes to DNA testing as well, Richard, something that he has pointed to. Just to take a few lines from Ian Bailey's solicitor, Frank Buttermere's statement, he's saying that Ian Bailey has welcomed this review. He says that it is no doubt the family of Sophie Toscan de Plantier will also welcome the review. Frank Buttermere says Ian Bailey has fought such a lengthy battle to seek a review and he will cooperate with the review to the best of his ability, adding that the review also confirms the unreliability of the murder conviction in France.
Yeah, and I mean, as Ralph was saying there, this is something which Frank Buttermere and Ian Bailey have both been calling for a long time. We'll actually bring in one point of view on this, and this is from speaking to Gardaí in Bandon Garda Station, which is one of the units which actually now handles this, is that the focus of what has actually happened over the last number of years with the podcast and the books and the documentary is that they do get calls all of the time now from people who might have listened to a podcast and just want to hear their theory put to Gardaí, which obviously doesn't really help anyone.
It's quite concerning.
So people just like speculatively going, did you think about this? And then and effectively then tying up Garda hours in asking them to reanimate old theories.
Yeah. Pretty much. A lot of off the wall stuff, which isn't even connected, and they tie it into global conspiracies and stuff like that. And that really is a waste of time. But this is something which there is still a family grieving at this. Mm. Sophie Toscan de Plantier's parents have come over almost every year to that farmhouse outside Skull. They weren't able to do it for the last couple of years due to poor health and COVID-19. Their time is running out to see justice.
Yeah.
Pierre Louis, who of course has been basically in the vanguard of pushing for justice for his mum, he wants to see this dealt with and dealt with properly. And it just feels like sometimes there is all this chaff and stuff that gets in the way of really what the core of this is, which is a woman who was brutally murdered and a family which has been left grieving many, many years left in the dark on this.
Mm. Absolutely.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So just when we thought maybe Dublin Airport was back on its feet or the front door of the nation was no longer banging off its hinges, Richard Chambers, to quote you from recent weeks.
I've had that quote read back to me on multiple trips to the airport.
It's actually probably nation's most memorable in rag order.
Yeah. I apologise for nothing. I tell the truth about that airport. The airport is in a bad way. It's gotten worse in the last...
You saw it firsthand in the last week, Sarah.
I'm going to be honest, I had a very pleasant experience at Dublin Airport, so I feel a bit bad saying that.
On the way back, I didn't realise that there were the problems that you saw on the way back.
Yeah, so on the way out, I'm going to be honest, got to the airport at 8:30, was through security after checking on a bag and everything by 10 past nine.
Got
to do a bit of browsing through the loop. Actually thoroughly enjoyed it on a Tuesday. Yeah. Things kind of kicked off afterwards. I will say coming back, I was absolutely horrified to see literally hundreds of suitcases abandoned in baggage claim in the arrivals hall. I sent you guys a picture. I mean, it was, you know, and I spoke to one staffer who obviously off the record didn't know who they were talking to probably in fairness, did say to me, yeah, this happens all the time. This place is a beep show. So
wow.
I was like, okay.
Insert your own adjective to describe that show.
I was like, okay. And I said, but why are they here? Like, and he said, well, people just left them there. And I said, there's no way people just walked off and left all these. And he said, well, actually, so what's happened is a lot of flights have come in and the bags have taken several hours to appear on the belt. So people just leave and they have to be posted out to them. But I mean, I don't know how they're going to post them all out. Some of them have been there for several days.
There are. And there's a few instances. And it's a big, big problem. And it's, again, it links into something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, which is COVID-19. Mm. But there's been a big problem with baggage handling, which is obviously not an DAA, to their defence, will say that this has nothing to do with them. This is third-party baggage handlers and individual airlines who handle everyone's bags. But it's been across Europe, not just at Dublin Airport, there has been an absolute shed load by multiples of bags which have gone missing, and people are waiting more than 2 weeks to get them back, and they're ringing, and they're tearing their hair out, and there's priceless valuables in some of these bags which have gone missing. That's one element of the disaster which has befallen Dublin Airport, which is not enjoying a good summer.
If those are bags from people who presumably already live in Ireland, because there's no way, like, you'd have nothing with you otherwise. So I presume a tourist has no option but to hang around the airport for like 4 or 5 or 6 hours waiting for their baggage to get off the carousel.
Well, a lot
carousel.
Of them aren't, because the bags are
But if they've got nowhere else to go, so you presume that a lot of the bags that are abandoned are from Irish people who at least have wardrobes at home to go to.
But I texted the tags on a couple of them. Like, they were international bags that were left there.
Whatever about the, you know, our little Stonehenge thing outside College Green and the new, like, ridiculous little table that we've got there. That can't be a great introduction to your tourism experience at the Spire College Green. But, like, what an awful introduction, like, to Ireland as a tourist then.
Banging off its hinges, as Richard Chambers would say.
Banging off its hinges.
Is that why we're bringing in the army?
The army. Well, this
can I say before you go on to this, right? This sounds like a WhatsApp rumor that you would try to dispel, but it's actually not a WhatsApp
rumor. Very Gibbo Ricey, she cheeks and all that from back in the day. But no, the army has been put on standby to come in and help the situation at Dublin Airport. We are told that they will only be deployed if there's a significant deterioration on an already bad situation. And if there are more and more COVID-related work absences, because obviously the security staff are very upfront. They're very up close and personal. In the previous Omicron spike, 1 in 4 security staff in Dublin Airport was off due to COVID-19. Mm. So the army has been asked to put people into immediate training. What they'll be doing is effectively, they won't be doing the security pat down or scanning.
Which is important, because the whole argument about a month ago when this was first raised was that the army were incapable of doing that. And if that was the pinch point, I think that's where they want to go.
And it would take 5 or 6 weeks to train them up. So, shorter training period if you have them on the fence or checking vehicles going to airside and all that sort of stuff. But the people who aren't happy about this are the army people, who feel that they are, once again, basically the who you're going to call option for any situation that may arise. They feel that they're cheap labour, that they're free labour, that they're being asked to bail out poor management at a semi-state company. Mm. And basically, at a time when they should be well-earned holidays after, you know, all of the work they've done during COVID-19
and
everything.
And being so involved,
but even all their work
COVID.
In the Mediterranean, all that sort of stuff, any deployments abroad, a time for them to go away with their holidays, with their families, they're being asked to go and mind the airport because, you know, things aren't working well there. I was at the airport there earlier on today. Aer Lingus has had a bad run of it as well recently. 12 flights cancelled on Wednesday, 13 cancelled over the weekend, more on Thursday due to these COVID staff shortages. A couple of people who I met at the airport today, starting with this Cork man and two women from Holland.
I was on the phone for 3 hours this morning on hold. Eventually got through to someone and they hung up on me. But I decided to come to the airport and they've now rebooked me. So I'm going from Cork. So I'm actually from Cork. So I'm going back down the road to Cork now. But I was in Dublin anyway, so.
We are from Holland.
Yeah, and you were here for the cancellation as well.
We had booked a flight at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but it was, we don't know, but we were rebooked on a flight at 6:15, but that flight is cancelled. And so we were stuck a little bit over here. And then we met this
helpful Cork man, yeah. Yes.
And he told us, I travel as well to Amsterdam and from Cork. So we started, okay, can we? No, he's stuck with two ladies.
So well, at least you get to see Cork now as well, like, you know, yeah. So, there's benefits to these things, yeah.
It was very short notice, and I'm absolutely starving, nearly fainting now, because I've been queuing for 3.5 hours and came straight from the bus and left Belfast at 8:30 in the morning. So surprised, to be honest, that I didn't get, you know, a text message or an email saying that the flight is cancelled.
So you just arrived here and you were just told when you got here that it was cancelled?
I just saw on the board it was cancelled when I was about to check in.
So real anger there amongst the army personnel. They feel that this isn't a national emergency, that they shouldn't be used in this way, that this is something which has been a political, you know, something which has been put forward by any politician who wants a few headlines. Mm. And now it's just coming because people want to be seen to be doing something.
Yeah.
Because the DAA obviously said this wouldn't help. And now they're like, well, this is a contingency measure. We need all the help we can get if things go properly.
Yeah.
Bad. But there's a lot of frustration there. And even the workers at the airport themselves aren't happy with this.
But if they do get deployed in this case, won't it be not just because of the lingering staff stuff and the fact that they laid off so many people in 2020 and are still only struggling to get them back? Won't it be because also there is lots of COVID around and lots of staff are missing? And that's one of those things where it's not down to anyone's mismanagement per se. It's not down to someone being sloppy or someone trying to cut too many corners now discovering that they've cut the thing too thinly. Mm. It's a case of societally, there's a virus going around, lots of people are off work, and there's only so much of that you can ever control, sure.
The problem is that there's still a shortage of staff there.
Yeah. Before that happened,
Okay. If you have a shortage of staff, and a load of them then go off sick with COVID-19.
Touché.
I do, and I do feel really sorry for the staff who are working in Dublin Airport at the moment, by the way, because the people who are actually coming in every day and going to work are doing a great job, you know, and you feel so sorry for them because they're obviously dealing with people complaining.
They have a rough ride of it. People
really
are getting them dogs.
Like they actually
there.
Do, in fairness. And you can almost sort of see it in some of their faces. They're just worn from the whole situation and they're still, you know, smiling and, you know, helping and go this way. And like, in fairness, I think huge credit is due, and it's nice to give them a mention now to the staff within Dublin Airport who are doing their best, but God love them. the airport is like, it's been cleaner. It has been cleaner. It has been more efficient. Like, it's probably just not really, it's not at its peak. But do you know what, though? I flew through Copenhagen coming back as well, and Copenhagen had its own difficulties as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to say that, like, okay, Dublin's not in great shape at the moment. You know, going through security in Copenhagen took ages of the day as well. You know, there were massive queues at check-in desks for bag drop-off. You know, you had a situation where you were trying to drop off a suitcase and they were closing the desk for an hour. I suppose in hindsight, looking back, they may have been closing that desk as a traffic calming measure to stop people going through security. But then the problem was you had people really stressed.
Then at baggage drop. Yeah. So it's far from ideal. And like, I think Amsterdam Schiphol had been something similar as well. There's been massive crowds there.
Yeah.
We saw before in Brussels that on arrival side, the passport checks are crazy because they are also dealing with a lot of bottlenecks. And instead of there being a steady throughput of people, they now have them all coming in fits and starts. And so sometimes there's no queue and sometimes you're there for half an hour. So it's not ideal anywhere. But I suppose the fact that, admittedly with the point taken that a lot of it is staff recruitment stuff, the fact that COVID is doing the rounds and is doing the rounds much more now than it was a month ago is definitely going to be a contributor. And if it continues to rise at the rate that it is, well, we're absolutely getting into territory where they're going to have to deploy the defence forces because there are simply so many COVID cases right now that it's impossible to think that the personnel won't be needed.
Yeah. It does. It kind of brings us on to another point that we were talking about earlier in the week, obviously, this idea of a potential new legislation around mandatory mask wearing. Because just in relation to the airport, I suppose, I was taken aback. Like, people aren't really wearing masks in the airport. It's obviously that you don't have to now. And even on flights, people aren't really wearing masks. I wonder, is there an argument to be made around that at this point, if that's affecting travel or international, you know, movement of people, that if you have to wear a mask on public transport, that maybe, you know, would planes be factored into all of that? Or is that something that...
So they possibly would. I think the rule, internationally speaking, is that you still have to wear a mask on the flight if one or other, either your point of entry or point of departure, if one or other of those still requires it to be worn in crowded settings, so that the plane kind of inherits the rule. So if Ireland were to go back to mandatory mask wearing and transport, then it would kick in those circumstances. Whether it will in Ireland or not, it was interesting that as soon as the rumour got out on Tuesday morning that the cabinet was looking at this, that there was a very concerted effort from people involved in government to immediately try and downplay or dampen this as a contingency thing. We're not doing it. We're not even thinking about doing it. We're just preparing the ground in case we have to do it. Because the emergency powers that used to exist that allowed the government to force you to wear masks expired at the end of March. There is no legal basis on which you could force someone to do anything to do with COVID anymore. And so if the need arises, they need to have a law drafted that they can bring to the Dáil and Seanad and say, here, lads, we need to bring back masks. Can you approve this enabling bill for us, please? And they are insistent that that's all it is, and that it will take so long to draft, it won't even be ready before the summer recess, let alone debated or passed. So if it is going to happen, it would have to be at least by the September when the Dáil comes back, which is 3 months away. And so it's hard to imagine you could do that much forward planning.
So it's
but the fact that they're doing it would suggest that they clearly don't, they haven't closed the door entirely. You wouldn't, if you thought, okay, this is what living with COVID looks like, you wouldn't go away and draft another emergency bill.
Yeah,
I don't think.
Well, it could be some sort of autumn winter planning, but we will watch this space. Speaking of autumn winter planning, the HSE is going to have to find a new person to run the health service in the winter because Paul Reid has announced that he's leaving, yet another high profile departure from the health sphere. Tony Hoolan's actually finishing up this week, by the way. He's wrapping
it's
up
Friday, yeah.
his
Friday,
role
yeah.
as the Chief Medical Officer this week. So we wish him well. Paul Reid, stepping down in December, first appointed in June of 2019, says he's leaving with a heavy heart, made the decision to move on and spend more time with his family, and a belief that the HSE was entering a new phase and that the appointment of a new leader was now timely. Well, by God, they're entering a new phase. I mean, that's pushing it mildly, is it not?
I just pulled my chair in closer.
I know, yeah.
I have takes.
Okay, unleash the takes.
Well,
okay.
I have a few takes myself, to be honest.
Look, the only person who knows why he has decided to call time on the HSE chief executive gig is Paul Reid himself. Mm-hmm. He's the only one who knows why he's done that.
Yeah.
It has been suggested to me by people that if you look at his in-tray and you have Navin, you have the CAMHS situation, you have Sláintecare, you have the waiting list, which of course were made horrible by the pandemic, the recruitment crisis, potential industrial action amongst non-consultant hospital doctors, the winter trolley crisis, the summer trolley
summer
crisis.
Trolley crisis.
Like record number of people on trolleys waiting for bed in the month of June earlier on this week. There is a feeling, and again, the only person who can tell us this is Paul Reid.
You haven't even put in the sixth wave of the pandemic there.
Oh, yeah.
We could have put in a million.
Is it six? I think we've lost count.
Yeah, well.
But there's a feeling that things added up.
Yeah.
and that if you were from the outside looking in, if you were Paul Reed, was now a good time to go.
Do you mean added up with a sense of like external pressures or people been like, well, hang on, how come all of these things are arising? Or internally because he was like, I only have 18 months officially left on the clock and I can't be doing with this. I'm exhausted.
A lot of stuff there, like, do you know what I mean?
There's a lot.
That's an intray. Like, you hear this whenever you appoint a new manager in football, that there's a big intray there of things to be done. Yeah. He came back from holiday with a big intray of things to do. Like, again, he is a man who lives in Carrick and Shannon. This is all widely reported at this stage. And the commute from Dublin from Carrick and Shannon is a lengthy one.
Yeah.
He has family who are living abroad. He would obviously like to see them more. It is worth saying, Zara, I suppose, that there's no secret be made at this point that he does not enjoy perhaps the closest of working relationships with the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly.
Yeah, I would say that there's, you know, a healthy, you know, robust exchange of conversations over time between those individuals.
Which is an analogy for he pulled them up in front of people. He's had blazing rows.
They've
with
had blazing rows.
He has rolled his eyes at suggestions rows, Stephen yes. Donnelly has made. And they don't get on particularly well.
The Department of Health and the HSE in general have a kind of a spicy relationship between them. They work together,
prickly.
But it's prickly enough. I mean, you know, it was well documented that, you know, he himself and Tony Hulin had locked horns a couple of times throughout the pandemic. Look, I think Paul Reed, you know, as a character kind of came into this in June of 2019. Obviously, within 6 months or whatever, 8 months of being in this job, you know, you're into kind of crisis mode, dealing with the pandemic. You know, I think much of his time in the HSE will be dominated by that, rolling out the vaccine rollout. I guess if you're Paul Reed, you're probably looking at this and thinking, I'd rather go now on a high note somewhat or as close to a high note as you're going to get before, as you mentioned, you have to really face into the realities of the list of things that are actually wrong there. I mean, it's hard to imagine a time when the health service was in... Well, I mean, I feel like we say this all the time about the health service in such dire straits, but I mean, it really is in a very bad place right now.
Like, you know, you said the words in your list of things in his intray, a summer trolley crisis. Like, we've been looking at figures this week of there being like 600-700 people in trolleys in emergency departments, which is the sort of thing that you usually get at the worst end of the winter spike. We're talking about this in the last week of June. It's not peak respiratory disease system. There's no winter flu doing the rounds at the minute. So the idea that things are as bad right now is clearly in pretty rag order. The thing about Navan Hospital and the relationship between Stephen, and again, I suspect that Paul Reed has just basically decided, I have done 5 years worth of work in 3 years. Don't forget the cyber attack, by the way, which if the pandemic didn't exist, the cyber attack would have been like the sort of crisis that would basically take years off you in your work.
Sending the army to fix that. They did.
Yeah, they sent it out to City West to do it as well.
By the way,
sure.
Has a great relationship with the Defence Forces and would be the first man to thank them and praise them for the work they've
chief
done.
Chief of Staff next. That'll be his next gig. But the Navan situation, like, it's an interesting backdrop. I don't think it's the germane thing at all, but it's a fascinating backdrop that there has been this very, you know, all those blazing rows between Stephen Donnelly and Paul Reed are at least all behind closed doors or in sort of certain fora. You don't often get situations where a minister is rushing out a statement to say, hang on, no, the government has not decided to shut down the emergency department in Navan yet, and then have Paul Reed going on national radio and go, yeah, we're doing it anyway. It's the right thing to do.
Can I say, I'm going to say something about this because we've spoken about this off the record, like amongst ourselves about this. Like, Stephen Donnelly's office hosted a briefing for the media about Navan Hospital being changed to a level two.
Yes.
It was hosted on a computer within the Department of Health. I was on the briefing myself. And, you know, that was facilitated by Stephen Donnelly's office, that briefing. And that conversation took place in the presence of people who work for Stephen Donnelly. And everything that was said about changing Navan to level two was all said within earshot and you know, in front of people within the Department of Health. So if they wanted on that particular day when that technical briefing, as they call it, to clarify anything before Colm Henry went out afterwards and spoke to the media about it, they had ample opportunity to do that.
Everything about it had their stamp of approval.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, as far as all the journalists on that call that day were concerned, absolutely. There was no reason to believe that there wasn't.
And the following day, there was a cabinet meeting and Helen McEntee is from Meath and concerns were raised about the ability of Drogheda and Blanchardstown to incorporate Navan's workload. And suddenly, Stephen Donnelly said, hold on there now, we haven't done it yet. Which is an interesting side debate as to whether ultimately you can ever fix health if you do get bogged down in some clientelism. Like, no one ever wants to be responsible for like telling people in a mid-sized regional town, sorry lads, we're downgrading your services. But it probably would be, by most experts' reasoning, to the betterment of the whole country's health service, because you could redeploy Navan then to do more laboratory stuff. It could help work through all those inpatient and outpatient waiting lists that we're hearing so much about. Like, the way to get rid of Paul Reed's intray is to do all this stuff, to perform all these services. And Navan's supposed to be able to do that if you close the ED. So then why is the whole thing being held hostage? Because there's one minister, albeit from my own county, I'd love if it was great there too, standing there going, can't close that.
Gavin and the parish pump.
Someday I will speak in my own native accent. You won't know it, hey.
Just want to touch on another thing that's obviously a big challenge for Stephen Donnelly this week as well. And at the time of recording, this hasn't been resolved. It is the pay for those who have long COVID. So frontline workers who contracted long COVID while working on the frontline, many of them on COVID wards, mainly a lot of people who would have worked in the early stages of the pandemic, March, April 2020, where they went to work when there were no vaccines. Obviously, there was very little PPE even at that time for them. Yeah. You know, people were really sort of, you know, answering Ireland's call and going and working on the wards. Those individuals now finding themselves in a situation where they're on a cliff edge. Their payment is due to be cut off by Friday, so the 1st of July, and they will be back on just normal sick leave. So this special pay with leave is now going to be wrapping up effectively for people who have long COVID. So they find themselves in a situation where they describe it as being cut off and kicked in the teeth by the government. Stephen Donnelly promised the INMO conference back in May that this would not happen. You know, he was very clear in saying, you will not find yourself on a cliff edge. We will look after these people. There's around 180 people affected by this.
We're now 27 hours away from that cliff edge. And we don't know anything yet.
Now, hopefully by the time this goes out, there might be a resolution. But what I want to play for you is a clip of a nurse who works in one of the major acute hospitals in this country. She worked on a COVID ward. She's 29 now, was 27 when she got COVID back in April of 2020, and has been unable to return to work. She wants to remain anonymous. We're calling her Mairead. But we want to take a listen to what her experience has been like and how she feels about how the government has handled this.
If the pandemic happened again, no, I would not participate, because where's my thanks for that? Like, they're going to, my life is just, as I said, it's so small. I'm living a shadow of the life I lived before. Like, I'm really only surviving instead of living. And now they're going to stop my pay. So it's a real kind of kick in the teeth after everything that I've already done. Like, I've worked 5 years in the healthcare service in the public sector, and we're just being left behind, and everyone else is moving on.
So thank you to Mairead for talking to us today. I suppose, look, it's just, this is the reality of what people are dealing with, and she's at a point now where she doesn't know if financially she's going to be able to survive basically after this Friday. So hopefully there will be a resolution found around that. Gavin, who is Cassidy Hutchinson, and why is what she said this week so important?
The new darling of the Democrats in Washington, because she apparently is prepared to spill some tea about the White House on January the 6th and that whole insurrection in ways that no one else would. Cassidy Hutchinson is an aide to Mark Meadows, who was, at the time of Trump's defeat and the subsequent events, was the White House chief of staff. So she had a real fly-in-the-wall approach and access to all of the White House meltdown around the election results and its fallout and then what happened on January the 6th. And there was a couple of interesting bits in the testimony that she gave this week to the January 6th committee, which is investigating all of this. There's the nice, like, showbiz anecdote stuff, like Trump throwing a plate against a wall and a cleaner having to take ketchup off it because he was so aggrieved at one of his own ministers basically admitting that there was no fraud at all. But there's one thing which was particularly worrisome about what she said, which is to do with the rally that Donald Trump organised, which then turned into the riot and the mob and the storming of the Capitol building. Because the defence that the Democrats or the Republicans and those loyal to Trump have put up about the whole thing was that, yes, Donald Trump addressed a crowd, but he addressed the crowd that were going down to organise a legitimate protest. He wasn't inciting them to go in and try to uphold some sort of armed insurrection. And what she has said completely and probably fatally undermines that, because Trump allegedly was complaining about how few people were inside the formalised rally area and was complaining about how that would look on TV, that it didn't look as packed as it could have been, and why wouldn't more people come into the area? And it was explained to him explicitly, the reason why they can't come into our formal security area is because they're all carrying weaponry of some sort and they will not pass the security checks, the airport-style checks, on the way into that fenced-off area. And Trump's reply explicitly was, I don't care. I'm not the one that they'll be threatening. I don't care if they're carrying weapons, because they're not going to be threatening me personally, Donald Trump. So stand down the security machinery and let them in. And having said that, and that now being on the record, does very materially suggest that Donald Trump knew the intentions of the people that were there in the crowd and then spoke in such a way as to effectively give them what felt like an instruction to go and not only protest at the Capitol building, but to storm it itself. And that's a very sinister turn on the whole thing. And there's a lot of other interesting gossip as well about how, for example, on that evening, Trump's own cabinet was considering invoking a little-known procedure to basically remove him from the job, to declare him unfit for office because of his behaviour on that day. And the only way in which they were encouraged not to do that was that Trump agreed to issue a video the following day, accepting the result of the election that he didn't accept, and agreeing a peaceful turnover of power. It's fascinating stuff, and we could nearly spend hours talking about the fallout of it, but I do think it's just worth reflecting on the fact that the most powerful man in the world knew that he was inciting a violent and armed mob to go down and stop his own defeat from being certified. And we've gotten blasé about how wild it's been for the last couple of years. We should reflect on just how crazy that statement is.
Absolutely. A final question on that, Richard. Do you think that completely changes his chances of re-election?
It's interesting because there's a couple of questions. First of all, does it ruin his chances of becoming the president once again? There has been a shift in the public perception in the United States around this. The majority of people do think that he should face criminal charges. Ron DeSantis is a name you're going to hear plenty of over the next while. He's the governor of Florida, a mini Trump. Some are saying now he's probably got more of a chance now of being the Republican nominee for president than Donald Trump himself. The other thing is, though, will there be criminal charges about this? Big ask. Justice Department don't normally do anything like this. It's a big leap to go from all this sort of stuff, which comes in a committee which is designed to hear all the bad stuff without hearing a rebuttal. So big, big questions about that.
Lots of questions to remain answered. We are out of time for this week. Thank you so much to political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Thank you for the chat.
And news correspondent Richard Chambers.
Thanks, Zara.
And thank you to you guys. I want to say, by the way, really enjoyed those voice notes last week, Richard. They were great. Nice to hear like the voices of people who listen to
Group
the podcast.
Group chat faithful.
Honestly,
always deliver.
Lovely to have the voices of the people who listen to the podcast on the podcast. And we're definitely going to do that again. So if there's something you are really annoyed about and you want to talk about it and you want us to address it, you can contact any of us on social media and let us know. And we'd love to hear your voices on the podcast. As I say, thanks for joining the Group chat and we'll see you again next week.
Bye. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.